Mr. President, you may wish to make some opening remarks.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. Look, I appreciate you joining us. I love coming to the NIH. It is an amazing place. It is an amazing place because it is full of decent, caring, smart people all aiming to save lives. And I truly believe the NIH is one of America's greatest assets. And it needs to be nourished. And I'm real pleased to be working with Elias and the good folks who work here to make sure that there's ample resources to fund these incredible projects that are taking place. And we'll talk about some of them today. The purpose of the meeting is to let the American people understand what kind of work takes place here and some of the practical applications of the discoveries that are being made. Obviously, we're all very concerned about cancer. And John, thank you for joining us. First, I'm pleased that we're funding cancer research. We're up about 25 or 26% since 2001. It's a commitment that I made when I first came to Washington. It's a commitment we're keeping. And the reason why it makes sense to spend taxpayers' money on cancer research is that we can make some good progress, and have. Interestingly enough, this is the second consecutive year there was a drop in the number of cancer deaths in the United States. And the drop this year was the steepest ever recorded. And the reason I bring that statistic up is that progress is being made. There are tangible results as a result of the research that takes place in around the country, and a lot of it focused here at the NIH. I had a fantastic experience today with some smart docs talking about how they can use genetic research, which Francis will talk about, to create cures for a lot of diseases. We particularly focused on kidney cancer today. And I strongly believe that it makes sense for us to progress and take advantage of the research of the Human Genome Project has yielded. However, I really want to make it clear to the Congress that I hope they pass legislation that makes genetic discrimination illegal. In other words, if a person is willing to share his or her genetic information, it is important that that information not be exploited in improper ways. And Congress can pass good legislation to prevent that from happening. In other words, we want medical research to go forward without an individual fearing of personal discrimination. Finally, I am real pleased about the announcement made earlier on the HPV virus vaccine. I don't know if our citizens know, but 70% of all cervical cancer comes from HPV virus. And as a result of good work here and other places, a vaccine has been developed that the government will dispense to those who qualify, all aiming to continue to build on the progress being made in dealing with cancer. So I'm very pleased with the job your folks are doing here. And I'm so grateful for you all to join us. I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say. You'll be happy to hear my long-windedness is about to end. But thanks for coming, Michael.
Dr. Zerhouni, maybe you could give some background on what's happening here at NIH.
Sure. First of all, Mr. President, let me thank you personally on behalf of NIH for your interest in what we do, your support in what we do. And this is your fifth visit to NIH. Yeah. Mr. President, you've been the president who has come to see us the most often. And this is a testimony to your commitment, not only to our research, but also to your plan for AIDS relief, your compassion about suffering that people throughout the world are experiencing today. And the only hope is really NIH when you really think about what we are about. I'd like to summarize the strategy of NIH for the next 20 years. Our goal is very simply to transform medicine from where it has been in the past, which is that you always intervene when the patient came to the doctor and you only try to cure the disease in the latest stage of the disease. Mm-hmm. That was very expensive, and it's not sustainable for the future. Because of the progress we've made, we can see a new era in medicine. Well, medicine, instead of being curative, in other words, when we strike the disease after it has struck us, we will strike the disease before it strikes us. And how do we do this is exactly what you saw this morning. Number one, we need to have ways of being more predictive about exactly what is the disease exactly in terms of molecular terms of genes and the relationship with the environment. Once we can be predictive, we can say who is at risk, what to do about that. But more importantly, we can identify in the population those we need to care about 20 years before the disease develops. And as you know, we've been so good at reducing, as you mentioned, mortality from cancer, mm-hmm. mortality from heart disease, that people today are not suffering from acute diseases like a heart attack. That has gone down by 65%. People suffer now from long-term chronic diseases that they live with for 25 and 30 years, like diabetes and Alzheimer's disease. That's going to be the threat for the future. Mm-hmm. So what we want to do is do the research that will allow us to predict better, to personalize, to have a precision-type approach rather than a one-size-fits-all, and the hope is to be preemptive. So that's really where we're going, from traditional medicine, wait until the disease strikes, to predictive, personalized, preemptive, strike the disease before it strikes us. And that's what our strategy is all based on.
That's good. I wish the people could walk the halls here at the NIH and meet the scientists and employees of this fantastic organization. It is amazing. You talk about young and smart and bright and excited. And all due respect, Ox, but there are a lot of really bright people here, which is another subject for another time, but we better make sure we get the right education working to make sure that our scientists are given the tools and encourage young kids to become scientists in the first place so that these halls remain full of people. Because as Doc said, he said, if we're not doing it, somebody is going to, and we want it done here in America. We want to welcome scientists here, too. And the other thing that struck me was the people from around the country, the globe that are here working. So anyway, you're doing a good job. We're spending about $28.6 billion here at the NIH, which was doubled from, you know, like 15 years ago, I think it was, or something like that. Anyway, good. Thank you. Michael?
John, why don't you talk a little bit about, particularly about the Cancer Genome Atlas. I think that's a fascinating development as it relates to HPV and other things that are happening in cancer.
Yeah, John, first, before you do, if you don't mind, National Cancer Institute, like, tell people what it is, how it works, if you don't mind.
Well, the National Cancer Institute, Mr. President, was one of the first institutes founded on the NIH campus, specifically directed at a disease. Celebrating its 75th anniversary. It's an institute that has tremendous breadth, and I often like to tell my friend the secretary and his colleagues that while we study cancer, cancer really is a model, a disease model that has impacted almost every other disease in one way or another. The things that we have learned by studying this model, our ability to track the best scientists to work on cancer, I think has had tremendous impacts across the breadth of disease.
And you've been so working with proud. Cancer for how long?
Do I have to tell?
Your hair gets half of it.
Well, I've been in business over 30 years.
That'd be fantastic.
I thought this morning, Mr. President, that I would mention a couple of initiatives that I think set the stage to talk about how our focus on genetics really impacts on our understanding of not only cancer, but really all diseases. As you know, there are changes in our genes that we inherit from our parents and grandparents, and then there are other those inherited risk or inherited changes give us a risk of developing a disease, cancer being one of those. And then there are changes in our genes that occur over our lifetime based on our exposure to the environment. Secretary Leavitt has been very interested in that throughout his career in public life in this relationship between environment and our genetic changes. The National Cancer Institute, we pioneered an effort to identify the common genetic changes that predispose a person to be at increased risk of developing cancer. And we've done that through a project that we call the Cancer Genetic Markers of Susceptibility, or CGEMS. We give everything a code in government, I found out in the year that I've been here. And I'm busy learning all those codes of the government, sir. This is an initiative that tries to look at the entire genome to identify the spots or pinpoint the spots in the genome where abnormalities exist. Once we identify those particular spots, we're able then to use some of the technologies that were developed during the Human Genome Project to actually then sequence those regions of abnormality or the genes there and to learn more about what the abnormality specifically is. We've recently pretty much completed a project on prostate cancer. We're well into one on breast cancer using this technology, and we're about to start one in pancreatic cancer. The other approach to this is a little different, and that approach really is based a lot on the Human Genome Project too, in that we take samples of the patient's tumor, patient's tissue, and we really do a complete sequence of all the genes in that tissue, much like we would if we were to address your genome and sequence all of your genes that make you who you are. That project we call the Cancer Genome Atlas, or TCGA for short, another acronym that we're fond of. And this is a project that demonstrates, I think, the collegiality and cooperation across the institutes at the NIH. It's a partnership between Dr. Collins and the National Human Genome Research Institute and the National Cancer Institute primarily, but others are involved at other institutes as well. And we're about to launch that project. We're well into that, picking sites that will participate. We've selected three tumors to begin this pilot project, lung cancer, ovarian cancer, and brain tumors. We depend very heavily in this, as Francis may mention later on the quality of the tumor and the tissue that we can get. We recognize that this is a complex problem. We recognize that it's not just technology, but that we have to bring the biology, the science of cancer together with the technology. But, you know, these are beginning projects, but I think later today you're going to visit a patient after we finish here, another patient with lymphoma, as I recall. And we've already applying this technology to being able to take a patient, for example, with lymphoma, and this is just one example, and where if you look at that tumor under the microscope, Mr. President, it would all look very much the same, one patient to another. But by using these technologies, we're able to really differentiate patients that look the same and identify that they actually behave differently. They have different prognosis, different risk, and therefore need different treatments. And so we're now, for the very first time, beginning to be able to match the characterized tumor, if you will, genetically characterized tumor, with a specific recipe of therapy. So we're making that kind of transition in a very rapid fashion right now. It's a very exciting time. In my long career, which you were kind enough to point out to me, sir.
Well, I wanted the taxpayers to understand here. Citizens understand we got a man of expertise here setting you up for success.
Well, I've never experienced a time when science has been so exciting and been moving at such a rapid pace. This is just an unbelievable opportunity. I'm very honored to be here.
Thanks for serving.
I'm honored to be here, sir.
Battling your way through all the initials.
Ely has mentioned the fact that the whole goal here is to become far more personalized. I want Francis to talk for a moment, but as I pass it to him, I want to relate a story that I think ties this together. About 5 years ago, I participated in a conversation with a man in a small group, and they were talking about the potential for genetics. And he wasn't a scientist, he wasn't a doctor, but he listened to it, and he said, there's something to this genetics business. He said, I'm 70 years old. Last month, I was diagnosed with macular degeneration. When my father was 70 years old, he was diagnosed with macular degeneration. When my grandfather was 70 years old, he said, if there's anything I can do so that my grandson doesn't have to go through what I am and my father and my grandfather have, I want to do it. Now, this genetic discrimination legislation you talked about is so important to this moving this forward, because it means that if people like that step up and help and make information about them and their health history available, and not only will it benefit them, but it'll benefit generations in the future. And it would be an unfortunate thing if anyone were then to be discriminated because of their willingness to contribute to science that way. Dr. Collins has been heroic in his advocacy, not just for this legislation, but also the genetic HapMap. And I'd like Dr. Collins to tell, he will explain that to you.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Mr. President, it is really wonderful to have you here at NIH today. I'm happy to be on this panel to share some of the excitement that we all feel about what's now possible. It really is a historic time. I know that word gets overused a little bit, probably by me, in fact, but in this case, the ability that we now have to understand how things work and how sometimes they don't work and disease occurs is unprecedented. Back in 1990, under Bush 41, the Human Genome Project got underway at a time where a lot of people weren't quite sure it was going to work. We had to read out all the letters of this human instruction book, and I think the genome is an instruction book. That's a pretty good way to think of it. And fortunately, with all of the talent that got brought to bear on this and the hard work that went into this and the federal funding, which was essential to making any progress at all, this project succeeded ahead of schedule and under budget, much to the delight of everybody involved, and produced this human genome in April of 2003, under your watch. So it's sort of nice bracketing there of the enterprise. And we now have, and it fits on a single DVD, the 3 billion letters of the human genome sequence, all nicely contained in this DVD. Now, if we had to print this out to actually look at the letters and put it on average paper of average thickness and average margins and all that, and pile the pages on top of each other, this would be as high as the Washington Monument. And we have that information inside each cell of our body. Mm-hmm. But a misspelling somewhere on one of those pages, if it's in a vulnerable place, is capable of causing a disease called cancer. Mm-hmm. And so I am enormously excited as a physician scientist that we got to the point of having that foundation of the basic sort of reference information, which is what the human genome was, and now we can begin to compare that reference sequence to what happens in a tumor or in somebody who's at risk for illness based upon family history. Secretary Leavitt mentioned macular degeneration is one of the early successes of this new era. And HapMap that he mentioned, which is probably an unfortunate term that nobody can really quite explain, it's basically an encyclopedia of the variations in our genomes. Your DNA and mine are 99.9% the same. That 0.1% is what HapMap was all about, to try to understand how that's organized across all of the human chromosomes. And that finally gives us the tool to be able to take a disease like macular degeneration, which has been an enigma, and search through the whole genome and find out what's wrong. You know, for many years, we've been in the situation of the guy who lost his keys somewhere at night and went to look for them, and what did he do? He searched under the streetlight because that's where he could see. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the times, the keys aren't where you're searching. And what the Genome Project and HapMap and this Cancer Genome Atlas now allow us to do is to light up the whole street. And that is an exciting time for scientists, and it's an exciting time for the future of medicine. So this Cancer Genome Atlas, which our institutes are partnering on, is basically bringing to bear all of these powerful tools of genomics to this disease called cancer, which we know is a disease of DNA. It's a misspelling problem. But we don't have the full catalog of all the misspellings. As we get those, each new one we discover tells us something about why this particular cell decided to grow out of control, which is what cancer is, and points us to new ideas about prevention and new ideas about treatment. And that is the real engine for discovery that we now can count on to drive both public and private research forward in a very exciting way. And while we're here to talk about cancer, the same is happening for many other diseases. The application of these tools, macular degeneration was mentioned, diabetes. I was on the phone this morning with a bunch of very excited researchers about new findings about adult-onset diabetes and the hereditary factors that are beginning to be uncovered there that may lead us to new ideas about prevention. All of this really fitting into what Dr. Zerhouni was talking about, the notion of personalized medicine, where instead of one size fits all, we actually appreciate that we're not all the same. You wouldn't go to a shoe store and just buy any old shoes off the rack. You'd want something your size. And medicine has largely been forced to do the generic thing because that's what we had the ability to do. We can do better now with this kind of information about individual differences. In that regard, though, I really want to underscore what you said at the beginning, and I very much appreciate your strong statement about the need for legislation to prevent genetic discrimination. Here at NIH, when we run a trial where we ask people as part of the trial to have a genetic test done because it helps us figure out who's responding and who isn't and why that might be, about a third of the people invited to do that decide not to participate because they're afraid that that information might be used against them in health insurance or in the workplace. And to be able to say to them, no, you don't have to be afraid anymore. This has been taken care of by effective federal legislation, like the bill that was introduced last night in the House, H.R. 493. That would be a wonderful step forward that would give us, I think, the confidence that this can really succeed. So I appreciate your support of that, going back to the summer of 2001 with your radio address where you pointed out the importance of doing this. And it sort of feels like the time has finally come where we're going to see that goal achieved. And I really do appreciate you making that a focus of today's conversation. So from my perspective, I've been here for 14 years, and I'm a physician who's trained as a geneticist, but my real dream was to see the study of the genome, this historic reading of our own instruction book, find its way into the practice of medicine. That dream is coming true, Mr. President, and we thank you for your support of all the ways that that's been possible and will be possible.
Sir, thank you for being on the leading edge of change for the good of mankind.
Becky, you've been through this in a very personal way. I think the President would be, we all would be interested in.
Where are you from?
I'm from Oakton, Virginia. I drove here. Outside of Vienna, last stop on the Orange Line. I'd like to thank everyone here today for asking me to speak on behalf of my family and the thousands of Americans who also have known genetic predisposition to disease. I've been asked to tell my story again today for a really important audience. And as you listen, I would ask that you please consider mine, but one example among many, of an incredible journey that has led us to the frontier of modern medicine. It's not at all insignificant that my family's story begins with another pioneer who braved a different frontier. My maternal grandmother came to America aboard an Italian steamship with $2 in her pocket, and we now feel certain the genetic mutation BRCA1. When she died of ovarian cancer at 41, she left behind five small children. One of those five small children was my mother, a spindly-legged four-year-old at the time of her mother's death. 30 years later, it would be her turn. My precious motherless mother was diagnosed with breast cancer at 35. It was 1967, and I was 6 years old. I can still see her, or rather feel her, a presence, wounded, worried, plied by her fears, a ball of love and brokenness. But her suffering was not yet complete. Within the next several years, her sister would be diagnosed not once, but twice with breast cancer, later with colon cancer. Her brother would develop and die from pancreatic cancer. Two of her first cousins would develop and die of ovarian and breast cancers. Her nieces were next. One was diagnosed with breast cancer at 32, and the other with ovarian cancer at 40. The breast cancer patient lived, the other did not. The last time I saw her alive was in this very building, where her doctors determined they could do no more for her. She died in June and left behind a darling 5-year-old. When I was diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer at 31, calamitous as it was, it came as no great surprise. We had long suspected a hereditary component to all the cancers around which we were now actively planning our lives. My younger sister led the charge for information, enrolling our family in research studies before there even was a BRCA1. But she and my older sister could not wait for results. Terrified by what had happened to me, they both opted for prophylactic mastectomies. BRCA1 was discovered shortly thereafter in 1994, but it turned out neither one of them had it. However, my 23-year-old daughter does. Katie graduated from Duke last May, beginning her adult life with an 85% risk of developing breast cancer. One of the good things about BRCA1 is that it's a mutation that comes with options, such as MRI screenings and prophylactic surgeries. One of the not-so-good things is that having a documented genetic mutation makes her vulnerable to more than just a devastating illness. She also faces the heavy burden of never knowing whether or when she will legally be asked to take a genetic test. She will lawfully be fired from a job because of the high potential cost of her medical care, or legally denied health or life insurance on the basis of her genetic predisposition to disease. But as bad as this sounds, the worst part about the lack of overarching legal protection is not the specter of discrimination. It's the fear of availing oneself of important research and the advances in medicine we have seen emerge from it. Many people are terrified that the same information that could save their lives could also lead to the loss of their insurance and their jobs, exposing their families to forfeitures that many feel are far worse and more enduring than the loss of their own lives. We will all gain much from the continuing advances in genetic science, but those advances should never come at the cost of basic fairness and equality under law. Dear President Bush, those are your words, full of the compassion and the sense of justice that have characterized your presidency. Last night, H.R. 493 was introduced in the House with 143 co-signers, 90 of them Republicans. This bill represents all that is right with America. Thank you for supporting it once again, for the sake of those here at the Outpost of Science who are giving their blood, their time, and their intellects to pave the way for the health of all Americans.
Thank you. It's compelling.
Yeah, it's strong. Thank you.
Not every cancer is one that we can identify as hereditary. John, you might want to talk a little bit about the cancers that are not hereditary and what we're doing to make progress on those as well. And
well, we work hard, Mr. Secretary, to try to educate the American people on the importance of the things that they can do in their personal lives to try to decrease their risk of cancer. Living a healthier lifestyle, decreasing one's weight, and increasing one's exercise pattern, all good words for all of us. The absence of the use of tobacco, the use of sunscreen to prevent skin cancers, and of course the screening programs that Becky mentioned a bit, the mammography, the colonoscopy, the pap test, the physical exams, the PSA for men. All these are things that are already available and already things that we can do to decrease our risk. One of the things that concerns all of us, though, is that we also need to work on the delivery of healthcare and the fact that we can make great advances in our science, and we will make great advances in our science, but we need to be able to get our science to where people live. And we need to work hard on that, and we've started a program at NCI in which I hope we can study how to do that better and how to get our science to the people where they live. About 85% of the people with cancer get their care in the communities where they live. They don't travel to distant sites to major cancer institutes or anything like that. They get it locally where they live. So we're working hard at NCI to look at that part. John Seffern of the American Cancer Society is often quoted as saying that one of the concerns is access. Access to care may be a greater risk than some of the other things that we're concerned about. And that gives me an opportunity, if I might, Mr. Secretary, to introduce our other guest today, Dr. Grace Butler. I'm going to say a few words about Grace, Mr. President, because she's a big helper to the NCI. She's
also a Texan.
Also a Texan, you're right. She's Professor Emeritus at the University of Houston. She's had over 30 years of teaching and administrative experience in higher education. More importantly, for today's session, Grace is a stage 3 colorectal cancer survivor. And as a result of that experience, much like Becky has committed much of her post-education years to working with us to fight this disease, and she's founded a nonprofit organization called Hope Through Grace. Grace, I think you have some comments you'd like to make today.
I do. Thank you, John. I thank you so much, Mr. President.
Thank you, Doctor.
For allowing me to sit beside you to share my story. I've been asked to share my story and then to tell you what has come as a result of my cancer journey. 7 years ago, I was sitting at my desk at University of Houston doing what a professor does. That was Wednesday. Thursday, I was in hospital at emergency. Sunday, Monday, I was looking in the face of the gastroenterologist who was doing a colonoscopy. Monday night, I was looking in the face of a surgeon. And Tuesday morning, I had major surgery. I'd been ailing for 8 months. And with no finding. Part of my story is that I never returned to that desk because my life took a defining turn from the academic setting to the cancer environment. I had very, very little knowledge of cancer. It was not on my radar at all. As a matter of fact, I'd been touched by cancer in the 70s. I lived in New York. I was a single parent, my dad, my daughter, my dog. My dad had prostate cancer toward the end of his life. He was ravaged by cancer. I prayed. I almost begged God, please, God, anything. Please never let me get cancer. In 1999, I was diagnosed with stage 3 cancer. I didn't understand because I talked to God. I did not understand. In my lowest moments, during the period of chemotherapy, I had never had the question of why, but I had the question of what. What, God, do you want me to do for you with this challenge in my life? I received an immediate reply. Go forth and serve my children who have been touched by cancer. When I got on my feet, the first thing I did was went to my church and established a cancer ministry with the assistance of my pastor, Pastor Kirby John Caldwell, at Windsor Village United Methodist Church. That ministry still exists, and it's thriving. It's a life ministry. People with a diagnosis of cancer often wonder, how long do I have to live? The life ministry is centered around living in faith evermore. It's still there. As I continued with the life ministry, I had the opportunity to participate in strategic planning. There was a strategic planning committee established to develop a plan to address colorectal cancer in the state of Texas. There I began to learn more about cancer. In one of the meetings, one of the administrators said that last year we had a pilot project. We went into the underserved community, and we offered colon screening. We found disease, and when we found disease, we sent them to the hospital for treatment. The other hospital said, you didn't do us a favor. We can't take care of these individuals. To my dismay, I asked the question, well, if you don't do the pilot project again, what's going to happen to these people? There was no reply. I continue, eventually they'll fall into the emergency room. Does it cost less? I left the meeting, continued my work with that committee. I left the meeting disturbed, perturbed, annoyed, angry, and I don't know what other words to use to describe that. A little tape went on in my head. Someone has to do something about this. The tape continued. I continued my work and found myself on another committee at the American Cancer Society. Almost a similar conversation. At that point, I asked, if you do not screen the underserved, the uninsured, what's going to happen? Will they be left to die? I remember very well sitting beside the gastroenterologist, just as I'm sitting beside you. And the person explained about malpractice and about the health care, a very cogent response. Then he turned and looked at me. He said, now to answer your question, the answer is yes, that we left to die. Mm-hmm. A lump got in my throat, and tears welled in my eyes. I didn't know what to do with that. Eventually, a vision came to do something. I was the someone who had to do something. And that something was to form the nonprofit organization, Hope Through Grace. Mm. We have three broad areas that we pursue. I'd like to go back for a moment, though. My name is Grace, but the grace that we speak of has nothing to do with Grace Bible.
I understand.
We have three broad goals that we pursue. One is education. We will go into shelters, churches. We talk to folk about nutrition, about physical activity and cancer risk and so on. Mm-hmm. The second broad area that we pursue is we now have a small grant to cover the cost of screening. Mm-hmm. That's what got me started in the first place. Mm-hmm. But it isn't all tight because we are still looking for healthcare facilities. If disease is found, we still need to be able to assist people mm-hmm. who don't have insurance, can't afford insurance. No one should die because they can't afford insurance. The third area of our work is survivorship support. We haven't begun that. We will begin as soon as the funds are generated for that to happen. With regard to community-based organizations, I would like to implore you, the Congress, others. Community-based organizations are a link in this whole process of research, of all the findings. Research is necessary. But the people at the grassroots, like myself and others, need help. We need help. We can't do it alone. We have a strategic vision. We have a strategic plan. We had folk to come in from the American Cancer Society, National Office, NIH, the State Health Department, and so on. We have a plan. But community-based organizations, if I could leave a message with you, they are an important part. We are an important part of this whole issue of reducing cancer in our community. Colon cancer happens to be one of the preventable cancers. Mm-hmm. Yet it's predicted 150,000 new cases mm-hmm. will be diagnosed. 50,000 will die. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't happen.
Right.
And I thank you, Mr. President, for your presence, for your listening, for your understanding and your empathy.
Thank you for answering your call. Michael?
Mr. President,
I think we could summarize today by saying that the future of medicine is personalized, to prevent and to preempt. We've heard today about progress that's being made. The elimination of discrimination, of genetic discrimination, is a very important, it's a vital step in reaching that vision. We've seen good examples of the progress, and we thank you for the time you've taken. You may wish to sum up, otherwise that
concludes. Thanks for coming. I'm excited, and appreciate the work being done here in Washington, the work being done at the grassroots level. I thank you for your articulate presentation, both of you all. And this government needs to support what's happening in order to save lives, and we will. Thanks.